It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Yesterday, President Obama made his case for closing the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, saying that keeping the detention facility open is contrary to our values and does not advance our national security. The prison, which opened in 2002 as a response to the 9/11 attacks during the George W. Bush administration, costs nearly $450 million to run. 91 prisoners remain at the prison. And at the heart of the debate over whether to close the facility is the question of whether the government can securely house or even try on American soil any of those remaining at Guantanamo. I'm joined now in studio by University of Pittsburgh law professor and expert on the legacy of Guantanamo Bay facility, Haider Alhamoudi. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
If you have a comment or a question for our guest, you can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Should the military prison at Guantanamo Bay be closed? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Haider Alhamoudi, does keeping Guantanamo open compromise our nation's values, as the president has asserted?
I think so. I mean, certainly throughout the Islamic world, Guantanamo Bay has enormous symbolic value as some example of the method in which there doesn't seem to be a rule of law. That is to say, people seem to fall into this eternal black hole. That's not entirely true. There's some level of exaggeration to that. But the idea and the principle of having this many people held for this period of time outside of American soil on an American military base does, I think, in many ways harm national security because it tarnishes the image of the United States abroad.
President Obama said Guantanamo symbolizes excesses that followed the 9/11 attacks. Do you agree? And if so, what are those excesses?
Well, certainly some of them have been curbed, but there certainly were excesses, in particular in the first part of the Bush administration. Even the Bush administration itself pulled back from some of these. You have the infamous, for example, torture memos, which I think are closely associated with Guantanamo. They weren't really directly linked explicitly to Guantanamo, but the idea that we could use these kinds of interrogation techniques, matters that have come up again, prisoners of war, as well as the level of people or the number of people who were picked up and sent to Guantanamo. Now, that number has been reduced steadily throughout the Bush administration and then even more during the Obama administration, so that you're down now to 91 people. But there were certainly people picked up in the early stages who didn't seem to be war criminals by any stretch of the imagination and just seemed to have been picked up for any number of other reasons and held for years. And I think those are good examples of some of the excesses that we saw immediately after 9/11.
Now, critics of the president's plan, including Senator John McCain, say it doesn't work and it fails to articulate a coherent policy for dealing with future terrorist detainees. How would you assess it?
Well, it certainly doesn't talk about the future detainees. Its focus is really on what to do with the 91 detainees that are currently in Guantanamo Bay. That's really where the focus of this entire plan is. And it is certainly short on some level of detail. It doesn't exactly say where these prisoners are going to go. At the same time, it does a very good job, I think, of describing, classifying the prisoners into different types, explaining which types are scheduled for transfer, and what the options are available for the rest of them. It is certainly short on details. One would have to have more details in order to implement any sort of plan. But as an initial proposal to start conversation on a meaningful way to close Guantanamo Bay in the short to medium term, I think it's a good first step.
And then, of course, there is the question of whether the government can securely house or try on American soil any of those remaining at Guantanamo. Can it?
Well, on the housing, I have to say I'm not quite sure I understand the articulated policy or the objection that somehow we're not going to be able to house these people. The number, the places that it is being proposed, of course, no one's suggesting that you release Guantanamo detainees onto the street.
Right. And when they say house, they're talking about a prison.
That's right. Supermax prisons, in fact. The ones that they've listed are places in which you already have the Times Square bomber, Faisal Shahzad. You have Zarnaev, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who who was the Boston Marathon bomber. Timothy McVeigh, of course, was held there until he was executed. So you're talking Ramzi Ahmed Yousef, the 93 World Trade Center bombing. We have some very, very dangerous people in U.S. prisons, and we haven't had a problem with breakouts. And if we did have a problem with breakouts, the problem would be much greater than just a few prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. So I'm not sure that there's really a problem in terms of housing them. In terms of trying them, of course, I think there does need to be a plan because there's so much publicity now around Guantanamo detainees that one might expect that at a trial at a courthouse there would need to be additional security. But again, we've tried all of these people that I've just mentioned without, or at least pled them out without significant incident. So I think it could be done.
And then to allow the plan to move forward, lawmakers would have to alter laws that prohibit the administration from spending any money on bringing detainees to the United States or even making plans to do so. I think a lot of us were not aware of such laws. Can you explain this for us?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. Congress has spoken very clearly that they don't want any detainees currently to be moved to the United States, and there's some level of bipartisan support. So polls seem to suggest this, and as a result, Congress has passed a number of laws about this. And so the president, I think, is hoping to change the law, but he hasn't actually, interestingly enough, ruled out the possibility of an executive order overriding these laws. And the interesting argument, of course, is that the entire system. That the only way you could possibly justify what's happened in Guantanamo Bay is through the idea of war, that this is somehow a war and this is the law of war and these are prisoners of war, and so you're holding them until hostilities end. And if that's the case, the president's argument, which he hasn't actually pushed yet because I think he's still hoping to get Congress to repeal some of these laws that cut off funding. But the president's argument is he is the commander in chief, and if these are military hostilities, he has to have some flexibility to house prisoners of war where he wants to. I mean, if you imagine a conventional war, imagine World War II, if you will, if the Pacific Theater, say, if we had a bunch of Japanese prisoners sitting in Manchuria and the president wanted to move them to Guam, you know, if Congress were to say, no, we don't want you to do that, we want you to hold them in Manchuria, I think the president would say, well, my commander in the chief, or aren't I? And the argument from the president is that he doesn't actually have to, or at least has raised and floated the balloon of, I don't have to listen to Congress on this point. I'm the commander in chief of the military, and this is a military matter. We'll see if he actually goes that far. If he doesn't, then he certainly would, because there's a series of laws that prevent, that cut off funding and prevent the moving of any detainees from Guantanamo Bay into the United States.
Now, you mentioned the example of POWs during World War II. I guess you could make an argument that we are at war or that we're not at war, couldn't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Couldn't you argue either way?
Absolutely. In fact, there's actually some the interesting thing is there's some level of legal acrobatics going on, because the people who would be most pushing the war paradigm, of course, are very much on the Republican side. And they've pushed very much this idea that we're at war and we have to be tough because we're at war, and have, in fact, the torture memos are built upon the Hugh Delahunty torture memos done during the Office of General Counsel were built upon under the first Bush's first administration, the principle that the commander in chief had a great deal of authority to conduct war in the way that he wanted to. And so all of this was done under the paradigm of war. You're absolutely right that a lot of us might say, well, what kind of war is this? Or if it is a war, it's a very different kind of war. It seems indefinite. We don't know when the ending is. It looks a lot different than World War II. But most of the president's critics, including those who criticize his decisions to move into the United States, don't question that war paradigm. So there's some level of legal acrobatics going on a little bit on both sides in assessing this issue.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the president's plan to close Guantanamo Bay, the military prison there. He is moving to do that despite reluctance from Congress, and we're talking about it with Pitt Law professor Haider Alhamoudi, who served as a witness for the defense in the cases of two Guantanamo prisoners, which we'll talk about. We'd like to involve you in the conversation. Your thoughts, your questions at 412-246-2002. Again, 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Should the military prison at Guantanamo Bay be closed? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Most detainees at Guantanamo have been held there for nearly 14 years without charge or trial. Isn't this a violation of international law? Is indefinite detention legal?
Right. So you have there's a couple of answers, I think, to that. You have the 91 prisoners who are left, 35 have actually been cleared for transfer. So the issue with them is that there's really no place to send them. The overwhelming majority, I think 29 and 35, are Yemeni. You can't send them back to Yemen. I think it's illegal. And even if it wasn't illegal, it's certainly off the table. And so they're having a difficult time figuring out where to send them. Now, as for 10...
Because the governments of prisoners make... apparently are not necessarily willing to take them back.
Yeah. I mean, there's two things that the United States demands when they retransfer them back, and they prefer the home country, although in a lot of cases they haven't done that. One are security assurances to make sure that they're being monitored, and then the other are humane treatment assurances. So, for example, the Uyghurs, the Muslim minority in China, it was the humane treatment they were concerned about. The Chinese, in fact, didn't really hide that if they picked these people up, they would immediately put them in jail, and they probably wouldn't be subject to humane treatment. And so a lot of the governments don't want them back. In the case of Yemen, I don't think the United States wants to send them back, given the chaos that's there and the vacuum that they would fall into. Both security and humane treatment would be an issue. But for the remaining ones, the 45, and so 35 are clear for transfer. 10 are in the middle of commissions. But you do have about 45 or so who haven't been charged yet. They say about half of them are going to be, but who knows? And then you certainly have at least a couple of dozen other ones who are just being held seemingly indefinitely. The argument has always been, and you know, it's one that the Obama administration pushes, although I don't find it particularly compelling, that they're prisoners of war. And under the law of war, one is permitted to hold prisoners of war without charge until the cessation of hostilities. That much is clear. So again, World War II, you imagine you pick up a bunch of Nazi prisoners, you can hold on to soldiers, you can hold on to them without charging them until the war is over. The problem with that war paradigm and trying to adopt it in this context is it effectively means lifetime detention because there's no real end to the hostilities in the way that there is in a traditional war.
What about the critics who say that Guantanamo detainees are too threatening to release?
And that's indeed the position of the Obama administration with respect to a couple of dozen. So at least of the 46 of the 91 who haven't been charged, at least half of them, they're suggesting a little more than half, in fact, they're going to continue to review their cases, but they can't charge them. They can't put them into traditional American district courts. They they can't transfer them. And so they say that they're too dangerous to be released. I mean, my feeling would be that if you can't find and identify a violation of the international law of war, pursuant to which you can charge them under a military commission, and you can't charge them in what we would call an Article III court, a traditional American court for a crime, you have a very hard time justifying legally detaining them just because you happen to think that they're dangerous. But that's not the position of either the Obama or the Bush administration.
Now, I mentioned earlier that you served as a witness for the defense in the cases of two Guantanamo prisoners. Describe what that was like. What is the justice system like in Guantanamo? And is the U.S. on solid legal ground right now constitutionally in terms of how things are being handled in terms of a legal process?
Right. So the thing is, as an expert witness, of course, you don't get the same opportunity to go deep into the bowels of Guantanamo itself. I didn't have to testify. I just submitted a couple of affidavits. But what I can say is that one thing that you definitely notice whenever you get near these things is the level of classified information that's sort of around. So while the defense does have an opportunity to review the evidence, almost nobody else does. And so the idea of a public trial isn't really there. They're very often closed. I will say there have certainly been improvements in the military commission's process when they from what was originally proposed to then what became the Military Commissions Act of 2006, struck down by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional, and then you had the Military Commissions Act of 2009. In each case, you have increased due process. You have, for example, now prohibitions against coerced testimony. You don't have Miranda warnings, and so you don't have the full panoply of due process. But at the same time, there's considerably more protections than there were in the past. At the same time, but that said, there are certainly issues that arise when one starts to talk about pursuing crimes on the basis of classified information. The other major issue that arises is the concern of ex post facto. That is to say that all of these things charged crimes based on things that were defined as crimes in 2006, 2009. What they claimed was, well, these are violations of the law of war, which always existed. And in some cases, that's true. In some cases, that's certainly true. It was a violation of the laws of war to, you know, 9/11 is an obvious example of that. I mean, it's murder as well, but it's violation of the laws of war. But there's a certain number of crimes, for example, conspiracy and other things that are defined within these acts that really are probably not even now part of the law of war, and certainly weren't at the time of whatever these people are being charged with. So there's a number of different issues that continue to arise with respect to the prosecution of detainees in Guantanamo Bay. But it is, to be fair, the process has improved markedly over the years.
To your knowledge, was there any kind of evidence or testimony of statements that were introduced based on the torture of prisoners?
At least theoretically, that's all supposed to be prohibited at this point. No one's supposed to be able to use coerced testimony. And I'm personally not aware of any military commission that used it. Now, obviously, the United States probably used this material in some way or other.
What else would they use it if you're torturing, you know? Enhanced interrogation, I guess, is the term that we should use. But if that is being administered, then, you know, what would the purpose of that be other than to build a case for prosecuting terrorists?
The other possibility is that it's used for intelligence. So you use it maybe to pick someone else up that you might charge. You might not use that testimony. Mm-hmm. It might be to prevent a terrorist attack. Certainly the argument that by those who defend enhanced interrogation is that somehow the United States managed to catch Osama bin Laden and the like using these sorts of techniques. So they could be used for intelligence and they could be used for trial. At least by the letter of the Military Commissions Act, one is not supposed to use coerced testimony. But the privilege against to the extent that someone actually incriminates themselves without having been Mirandized or the like, all of that is admissible.
And what did you? I'm just curious what you came away from that experience thinking about. You said you didn't get into the bowels of Guantanamo, but that you were there. You got around. You know, what did you take away from that experience?
Actually, I wasn't actually there.
You were not there.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. All you had to do was submit an affidavit from afar.
Okay.
So, but I don't know. I mean, the thing that you do really take is what one gets used to when one does expert testimony, and as I've done in any number of sort of federal district cases or cases abroad, you know, the United Kingdom or the Netherlands, you're used to getting a load of paper, mm-hmm. And then reading through a lot of documents, some of marginal relevance, but spending a lot of time doing that because you want to make sure you understand the whole record. And in Guantanamo, you get none of that. And so one of the major things I was being asked to testify in one case was a person who was picked up who was apparently a Shia and was being charged with being a member of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which, you know, is sort of like an African-American being picked up and being accused of being a member of the KKK. It really makes no sense at all in terms of the level of hostility that Al-Qaeda has towards the Shia. And so, you know, what I was expecting was a lot of documents about this, and I got things that were crossed out and things I couldn't read anything. And I just didn't, I'm just not used to that.
Because it's classified and
yeah, classified or redacted. And of course, I'm not part of the defense team in that sense. And so, you know, I don't get access to it. Now, I didn't need it per se, but it just felt like, you know, that's not how we run criminal prosecutions. I mean, all the evidence should be out there. And so it's not how you do a civil case normally in the United States. And so it did come as something of, a surprise, I suppose. I mean, maybe I knew about it, but I hadn't really internalized it until I was involved in these processes.
Why should Americans be concerned about the issue of whether Guantanamo stays open or not?
Well, I think it's important for us to have a positive image in the Islamic world. I note that a lot of people criticize President Obama for failing to call terrorists Islamic terrorists, and you have to come to terms with reality. But I think a lot of people making that criticism should also be aware that there's no credible method of fighting Al-Qaeda or ISIS or any of these extremist movements, whether you want to call them Islamic or not, without the support of large numbers of moderate, the vast majority of moderate Muslims who are the victims, the primary victims, in fact, in terms of the number of people killed of these terrorist groups. And so it is important, I think, to create and promote that image that's more positive of the United States. I think when the president visits Cairo and gives a speech, that helps. When the president goes to a mosque and gives a speech, that helps. When he's criticized for going to a mosque, even though he's gone, you know, I mean, all of them go to churches and synagogues and all sorts of places of faith all the time, but it becomes a controversy to go to a mosque. That sort of stuff detracts, I think, from national security. And sitting on the very pyramid of the thing that sort of detracts from national security is the advertisement for Al-Qaeda, is Guantanamo Bay and the image of the orange jumpsuits and the images that all of that, that creates, which is, I think, very destructive to a national image that needs to change in a part of the region that we as the United States have are deeply invested in.
At the same time, we as Americans are clearly worried about terrorism, and in the minds of some, the idea of having terrorists held in the United States rather than in a distant place is frightening. How much is that part of the challenge of closing Gitmo?
I think that's the major challenge, frankly. I don't think it would be hard to move a lot of these people into the United States. I will say a lot of the international law concerns that you raised earlier, Paul, would still be there. I mean, you know, you'd still be holding people without charge. You'd just be holding them in Kansas instead of Guantanamo. So you'd still have international law issues. I don't want to make it sound like closing Guantanamo would solve all these problems. But at the same time, I do feel like the fear, so while it doesn't solve them, it does sort of eliminate a symbol. I think it would be relatively easy to do. I think that the major concern and the big stumbling block is this fear that somehow if these detainees get into the United States, that all of a sudden there's going to be some sort of massive threat to the American peace and order. And I respect the fear, but I don't think it's entirely rational given how good we are at protecting our supermax facilities and given how dangerous it would be if we weren't good at that, irrespective of whatever happened with the detainees.
Last question for you. Obama has a year left in office, less than. Do you think this is going to get done before he leaves?
I don't think so. If he really took an aggressive route and decided he was going to go by method of executive order, it's possible, but that would be so controversial, and I'm not sure he wants to pay that political price. And so I think it's unlikely that it would happen. I think it's because of this fear. It's possible, but and I hope I'm wrong. But if I was a betting man, I would bet against it.
We've been talking with Pitt Law Professor Haider Alhamoudi, who served as a witness for the defense in the cases of two Guantanamo prisoners, talking about the president's plan to close Guantanamo, the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Coming up, it's Oscar week, and we'll look at the state of the movie business in the Steel City. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.